lightning bugs, Japanese beetles, and cicadas already. Our early spring put insects ahead of schedule, and guess what? They're still ahead of schedule. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here today. We'll talk about the early emergence of a number of different insects this summer. Lightning bugs and cicadas are welcome early guests, but coming early may give Japanese beetles a chance to cause even more trouble than usual. Horticulturist Richard Duran will also be here today, and he and Donald will answer your questions about plants and bugs. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we spent a lot of time this spring talking about how early the flowers and insects were emerging. And it turns out that at least in the bug world, things are still ahead of schedule. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here with me today. Hi, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
And we have seen fireflies flashing for a few weeks now, since mid-May, which is very early for fireflies. But we just started hearing another bug that's way ahead of schedule, right?
Well, at least in my neighborhood, as I walk the dog toward evening, just about dusk, I have started just this week to hear the scissor grinder cicada. That's one of our annual cicadas. It's one that we hear buzzing in the treetops. And normally I think of cicadas as sort of a July thing. And here they are on the 13th of June. I hear them in my neighborhood just at dusk as I'm walking the dog. Others have reported it too. I've heard from our county extension office in Scott County. I've heard from other county extension offices that, yes, the cicadas are out also.
Well, actually, I heard them this week as well. We were out playing with the kids a couple of nights ago, and my son said, "What's that?
What is that?" And of course, one of the folk tales about cicadas is that signals the end of summer. We are over the hump. We're past the middle of summer. We're coasting into back to school time. We're coasting into fall. We're coasting into frost. So that's not a happy sound for everybody who associates cicadas with end of summer.
We, as I mentioned, spent a lot of time this spring talking about how early everything was. Why are we still so ahead of schedule?
Well, we are not as far ahead of schedule as we used to be. We had that warm weather back in February and March, and that got us as far as 4 weeks ahead of schedule based on temperature units. Plants started to grow more quickly back then because of the warmer temperatures. We had some early emergence of insects. We had that mass emergence of fungus gnats back in April. Then it cooled off a little through April and into the first part of May, and we started to trend closer to normal, but we are still 2 to 2.5 weeks ahead of schedule based on the amount of heat or the temperature that has accumulated since winter. And insects are cold-blooded. They respond to environmental temperatures. When it's warm outside, they are warm. And when it's warm, they start to grow. So it's mostly temperature-driven for both plants and insects.
So what happens now? We are clearly not at the tail end of summer. We're not sliding into autumn right now.
And, well, I should say my professional answer is wait and see, because I really don't know what's going to happen next. I have the same worry in my own garden, that things flowered earlier than they should have, and my lilies are about done, and I kind of count on those for the late summer bloom. And what am I going to have left? Everything has already run its course, and except for the annuals that sort of fill in the cracks and corners, but my perennials have already started to run their course. My expectation is that for insects, we have some that have arrived early because they were in a place where they warmed up early, but the insects will probably last about the normal amount of time. It's just going to be the same number of insects stretched over a longer period of time because we grabbed the front edge of that bell curve and we stretched it forward I'm not sure the whole curve stretches that way, the whole curve moves, or whether we just stretch it out over a longer period of time. So my prediction for things like Japanese beetles that have started early is same number through the course of the summer, some of them starting earlier, but probably lasting about as long as normal.
Will that impact the population next year if the insects are going into fall and winter mode before it's fall and winter?
Well, another example of one that comes to mind that illustrates your question about how are population insects determined. What has been your experience the last few nights with mosquitoes while you're playing in your backyard?
Not a lot.
Not a lot. And it's because they have not had favorable conditions for reproduction. It's not how many mosquitoes survived last winter. It's not what were they doing in that warm period of the spring. It's how much standing water do we have for mosquitoes to lay their eggs, for larvae to develop, for reproduction and growth to occur. So the answer to your question for other insects is it will depend on what happens next. One of the things we think happens with Japanese beetles is that when we get those midsummer droughts, it tends to suppress the population, not eliminate it, but it does tend to suppress them. So lack of rainfall the rest of the summer could reduce other insect populations as well as mosquitoes.
Well, let's talk about the Japanese beetles because, as you mentioned, they are emerging early. What does the population look like this year? We haven't had a lot of rain, but are we seeing a lot of Japanese beetles?
Not yet, but we are at the very beginning. The early arrivals have already appeared, and these are the first ones. These are the eager beavers. You might call them the early adopters. They are the ones that get out first, probably because they were an area that had more sunshine, they had more moisture, they had warmer temperatures, where they spent the spring about 4 to 6 inches deep into the soil. So these are early arrivals, and we have not yet seen the peak. We're not at the middle of the population to know how it's going to be. The word that describes Japanese beetle infestations, though, is spotty. Some of us will be overrun, and my climbing hydrangea is likely to be defoliated again. People's crab apples will be defoliated. Down the street, they won't see any at all. And it's just that spotty nature of the insect to be clumped in some areas and not in others. So as they get around, more and more people get to see them, more and more people get to share them, but not everybody will have the same experience with Japanese beetles through the summer.
But if they're emerging early, and clearly they are, the things that they feed on are going to be a little bit different too, won't they?
Sure. That it's hard to be a grape grower when you have a Japanese beetle infestation because you spend a lot of time and attention trying to keep the foliage on the plants. If you want to keep the foliage looking good on your linden trees, and if you want your roses to bloom and look good at this time of the year, you have to do something about it to mitigate that damage. And that's starting earlier. So the roses are likely to be defoliated sooner. Maybe a larger number of rosebuds will be damaged. Maybe the grape defoliation will be a little more severe for some of us because it's going to occur over a longer period of time.
A hard year for grape growers anyway.
Oh, it always is. And apple growers as well, with the frosts we had back on April 10th, may have ruined the crop for some of them anyway. And now they have to face the double whammy. If an apple grower faces a Japanese beetle infestation, are you going to keep leaves on a tree that's not going to produce? There'll be a lot of tough decisions this year.
So if you are facing a Japanese beetle infestation, what can you do about it?
Oh, it sort of boils down to three non-perfect choices. One of your choices is live with it. The linden tree is going to survive, even though it looks brown from Japanese beetle defoliation. It is going to survive. If you can just sort of close your eyes and pretend that it still looks green, you save yourself a lot of aggravation and cost of treatments and so forth. So one of the things we can do is live with it. Maybe we can shield some plants. If you have rosebuds that you really, really need to have at a particular time right in the middle of Japanese beetle season, you can actually cover the plant with cheesecloth, some sort of a wedding veil fabric or something that protects the plant from the beetles that want to climb onto it. So deal with it. Live with it, keep them off. If you're going to use insecticides, you've got a couple of choices. One is to start as soon as the beetles start. Spray early, spray often. We don't have any sprays that are a magic bullet that will eliminate the problem for you and keep them off forever. So if you're going to spray, you're going to have to spray often. And your fourth choice is to use a systemic insecticide. These are placed on the ground around a linden tree, for example. They go up into the tree. They poison the beetles as the beetles feed on your tree. It does not make your tree repellent. It does not keep the beetles off your tree. It kills them after they start to eat it. The problem is, if you're going to rely on that technology, you should have already done it. And if you haven't done it now, you need to do it immediately if you're willing to do that, knowing there is a risk of putting insecticide into linden trees because some of that insecticide ends up in the flowers where the pollinating insects may be exposed to that insecticide. And Richard and I looked at linden trees as we were walking to the studio today. They are in bloom right now, so we may be past the time when the highest risk to pollinators would be from occur from the application of systemic insecticide to those trees you want to protect.
If you choose to spray, does that also mean that you could be impacting populations of pollinators and other beneficial bugs as well?
Of course, and the population of neighbors and everything else, because if you have a good-sized crabapple tree that you're trying to protect, you're spraying insecticide up in the air where it may drift over. Because many of our flowering trees, I'm thinking of crabapples and some of the purple-leaf sand cherries and others that the Japanese beetles attack, because that flowering period is past, there's less impact on the pollinators. But as the animal ecologists have told us for decades, you can't do one thing. You can't put insecticide on a tree and expect only to kill one species of insect. So there are trade-offs to consider.
And anecdotally speaking, I don't see a lot of pheromone traps anymore, so maybe you're getting the word out to everyone, but you don't recommend buying a pheromone trap.
No, we still don't. The pheromone traps and the feeding lures will catch lots of insects, and sometimes you can run the trap over. My trap runneth over with Japanese beetles that have been attracted in. The few thousand that you took out of the population in your trap had no impact on the larger population, and what we continue to learn over and over is that the Japanese beetle traps attract more than they catch. And so you will actually increase the number of Japanese beetles in your backyard with a trap. If you want to use a trap, put it far away from whatever you are trying to protect.
You suggest the neighbor's lawn, right?
The neighbor would be a great place. We can be very generous and buy a trap and say to the neighbor, here, I like you. Put up this trap, would you please?
I'm talking with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. And in a moment, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension horticulture, will join us. And they'll both answer your questions this hour. So give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. The phones are open. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist, and horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension is also here with us today. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And we've been talking about how far ahead insects are. Are we still seeing that plants are a couple of weeks ahead?
Definitely. Maybe not as much as they used to be. Things like the peonies, they bloomed about 2 weeks before normal. Certain things like tulips and daffodils about 4 weeks before normal. So things that are slowing down a bit, but everything is still a little bit ahead.
So do you think we'll have a period at the end of the summer where we're kind of out of blooms?
Well, we always have. And at the end of the year, we have things like garden mums and asters and sedum. And so we'll probably have things in bloom probably into October, November, possibly.
With wildflowers or prairie flowers, do we sometimes just see their season extended because they don't get killed off by frost?
Not extended. I would say they're basically blooming just like the cultivated plants where they're ahead. And things like, for example, Monarda may be blooming right now when it typically would bloom in July. So we're seeing that as far as native plants, too. So maybe toward the end of the year, there might be a period where we have fewer blooms.
All right. If you have questions for Richard or Donald, give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll start off with David in Des Moines. Hi, David.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a question about my purple cone flowers, and I believe it's being affected by a disease that I believe is called aster yellows, where cones are kind of mutated, mm-hmm. and there's green growing out of the cones and like leaves growing out of the buds or whatever you want to call the buds.
There are actually two possibilities there when you have that deformed flower. It might be aster yellows, but it also could be due to a very tiny little mite.
Okay.
And so there's actually two possibilities. It's hard to really tell by looking at them. You almost have to tear the flower apart and have an entomologist actually find the little mite.
Which is hard to do.
Right.
And, of course, even if you do find the mite, the thing to do is you're going to cut off those deformed flowers to try to eliminate it if it is a mite. And if the new ones come out and look pretty good, then we think, well, yeah, it was the mite and we were right. But if the new growth comes out and still looks deformed,
then it might be aster yellows, and that is a permanent situation.
Right, got to
and
cut
so
out the whole
you would,
plant.
You would dig up the plants and destroy them. So that's key. Is it the mite, which is temporary, or is it the aster yellows, which is permanent?
So cut out what I can and just watch.
And see how the plant responds to that, yeah.
Okay.
All right,
thanks
David.
Much.
Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we've got Pam on the line in Kellogg. Hi, Pam.
Hi there. I've noticed that right away, as soon as the little plants emerged, right away the squash eggs were already laid on the plants. And so in the past, I've tried mechanical means, picking them off and giving them a lot of attention without pesticides. I've tried not growing them for a year or two. And so this year I tried again, and sure enough, they're right back. Is there really any way to keep squash bugs from killing your plant?
You're doing it. The mechanical control works in small numbers, or if you have a small number of plants and if you have a small number of squash bugs. And if you can make it your hobby to turn over squash leaves a couple times a week, find those squash bug eggs at the angles of the veins on the undersides of the leaves, or to find the squash bugs while they're still small and either squash them or pick that leaf off and discard it. So mechanical control works in small numbers in small garden plots where you have the time to do that. Otherwise, insecticides sprayed on the underside of the leaves will help, and you can use organic treatments such as neem for this one.
Mm-hmm.
It only works against the very small nymphs, so right. You have to start early, and you have to find them at the right time. If the plants have already started to blacken, if the leaves have blackened from the larger squash bugs, it's not going to work. So I'm going to add squash bug to the list, Charity, of fireflies are early, cicadas are early, and squash bugs are early, because
right.
We shouldn't be finding squash bug eggs quite this soon.
That's what I thought. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call,
bye.
Pam. Next up, we've got Walter on the line in Webster. Hi, Walter.
Hi, how are you? I want to ask your guest about the problem I'm having with my strawberries. The strawberries are just beautiful this year, but there's a little black bug. Especially with the berries laying on the ground, and they're just eating them. They're eating them.
Yes,
and,
they do.
I don't know what they are and how to get rid of them, and I'd sure like to know.
Little, almost a quarter inch long, maybe only 3/16 of an inch, shiny black like patent leather.
Yes.
Yep. Some of them have four yellow spots. Some of them don't. Technical name for these is sap beetle, S-A-P, sap beetle. The common nickname for these is picnic bug, because in addition to being attracted to the overripe strawberries that are in the garden, or especially the damaged strawberries that may be laying against the ground, they're also attracted to your picnic, and they will land in your potato salad, and they love fermented beverages, and so they're quite common that way as well. Picnic bugs are attracted to damaged fruit, overripe fruit, fermenting liquids, that plant sap and so forth. Clean picking is our best defense against them, but you and others are reporting the same thing. There are more of them this year. They're off to an earlier start. Insecticides are not a good choice because we're harvesting at the same time the sap beetles are there. So my suggestion is pick every strawberry that's ripe, eliminate it from the patch, and keep it completely away from the patch, and pick the strawberries just a little earlier than you normally would to make that area as unattractive to sap beetles as you can, knowing that that won't be perfect, but it's probably the best you can do without some heavy use of insecticides.
So picnic bugs, also on the list of what's early this year.
Let's just keep a running total. Okay. How many early bugs can we get?
All right, Walter, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to John on the line in Adams County. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Well, what's your question?
Well, I just wanted to know if somebody could tell me the difference between the blackberries that you see growing in the ditches in the country and the cultivated blackberries that people have in their gardens.
Well, the cultivated varieties tend to be more productive, but they're also more susceptible to disease also, or tend to be. The ones that you find in the wild are typically found in roadside ditches, in partially wooded areas. They taste very good. They're not as productive typically. The fruit tend to be quite small in size. So that's the main difference. Cultivated ones typically produce more fruit, have bigger fruit, but can be a little bit more susceptible to disease.
With regard to the wild ones, is there anything you can do to promote the fruit production?
Probably not a great deal, actually. I suppose you could do some thinning or pruning of trees, so you might have better light penetration. You might prune out some of the dead wood in the plant, that type of thing. If there's competition from nearby shrubs, maybe eliminate them. So you might be able to improve the growing conditions somewhat so they would be more productive.
But they're still wild plants.
They're still wild. They won't produce as well as the cultivated varieties.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your question, John. And you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm talking with Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture and Donald Lewis from Iowa State University Entomology. And next up is Mike from Webster. Hi, Mike. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, I discovered a blackberry patch this spring, and I thought they blossomed okay. Now the berries are starting to show up, but there's not the big berries. There's just a few of the little BB things that make the berry on the plant. Do they get frostbit, or what's the problem there? They're in full sun. They're pretty much in control of the area, which is probably 60 by 60. And I was just curious, how come they're not making the big berries?
They might have a virus or some disease that is affecting the actual development of the fruit. Viruses are very common on the wild brambles. And you might see that as far as it may affect the foliage, but it may also affect the actual fruit development, where they tend to be very small and very seedy if they have possibly a virus. So it could be a viral infection.
Is there a way to get rid of that?
If it's a virus, no, because that's something that's in the plant. It's not a fungus. It's not a bacterium. It's actually a virus. So once a plant has a virus like that, it's kind of a permanent situation. So most likely, if it is due to a virus, they will not be productive next year either. So it's kind of a permanent thing.
I see. Well, they're really in control of the area because they got new shoots coming up everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And what it is, in an abandoned farm place is what it is, and they bulldozed it.
Okay.
And the DNR bought it, and I discovered this patch, and I'm thinking the people that live there probably planted these.
Very well could have. Right.
And they've really taken off the last few years, and I just discovered them this spring.
Right. When an individual wants to plant raspberries or blackberries in Iowa, we typically tell them if there are any wild brambles in the area to destroy them, because oftentimes they're disease infested. And, for example, the virus is transmitted by a sap-sucking insect. So if you have some wild brambles nearby, if they are disease-infested, and you plant some cultivated raspberries or blackberries, oftentimes they'll get that because the insects transmit the virus from the wild plants to the cultivated plants. And on the cultivated plants, it tends to be much more devastating.
Oh, interesting. And the wild ones taste so much better, too.
They do. They do.
It's frustrating. Well, thanks a lot for your call, Mike. And let's go to some email questions. This is from Pamela. And she says, we have some impatiens and coleus. Is that how I say that?
Yep.
Okay. Around a tree in a partially sunny part of our yard, the impatiens are doing well, but the coleus don't seem to be growing at all. They haven't been eaten, I don't think, but just aren't filling out. What can we do?
I'm not sure what the problem is. I would say the coleus does best in part shade, where they may get maybe 2, 3, 4 hours of sun. They're not demanding. I would just make sure they have some moisture if they're dry. But beyond that, they're pretty easy.
Okay. And this one's from Sandra. I just applied the Merit granules and watered them in for the river birch trees. How long before the tree has taken up the insecticide? I saw my first Japanese beetle yesterday.
This is a great question that gets a variety of answers. The manufacturer will tell you 3 to 4 weeks is the time for the maximum uptake of that insecticide to go into the ground, in through the roots, up through the trunk, and reach the ends of the leaves. Other people think it's much faster, like 1 or 2 weeks, and there are some people who actually believe it's instantaneous, but no, we don't believe that at all. So it's going to be measured in weeks that before it's up there. We hope the Japanese beetle emergence slows down so that that plant has a chance to move that insecticide up before the worst of the beetles arrive, but she will get some protection. Put it on the calendar next year to do it a little earlier.
Okay, and this one is from Amy. Good morning. We've had sedum, autumn joy, in our yard for over 6 years, and this year is the first time we've ever had an issue with pests. There seems to be something, maybe aphids, literally chewing away at the leaves, lots of jagged edges and little black dots on the plants. I've been using an insecticidal soap, Dr. Bronner's peppermint mixed with water once a week, which seems to be helping a bit. Is there something more I can do? They're shredding my newest shoots of autumn joy, but not another variety, which is frosty morn.
Ooh, we can leave the aphids out of that since aphids have sucking mouth parts. And also the insecticidal soaps work very, very well against soft insects like aphids. Aphids cannot chew the edges. They can't make it ragged looking. They would only suck the sap and we wouldn't see symptoms of that. I'm guessing variegated cutworm is an answer, and I'm guessing that because I've had so much variegated cutworm damage in my own garden this year and lots of phone calls about variegated cutworm. This is another pudgy caterpillar that works at night, but unlike the regular kinds of cutworms, this one is nicknamed the climbing cutworm, because they do climb up and they feed on the foliage of tomato plants. They will feed on green tomatoes. In my garden, they chew very lengthy oblong holes between the veins on hostas. We see them feeding on a large variety of things. I have not seen them eat my sedum, but maybe it's because I just don't pay enough attention to sedum at this time of the year. I wait for it to bloom, and then I start to notice it. So my guess is climbing cutworm. My suggestion is go out at night, strap the flashlight to the top of your head so that you can search around on the ground at the base of the plant, see if you can't find a cutworm that's caused this kind of damage.
Okay, thanks a lot for your question, Amy. Yo is on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Yo.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have a very well-established pine tree or fir tree. I don't really know what it is. The needles are less than half an inch long, and the cones that it used to make are about an inch and a half. And it's like 30 feet tall, and I've noticed that the tree appears to be dying.
From the top or from the bottom?
I think it looks worse from the bottom.
Okay.
But it also doesn't look too great at the top.
Okay.
The top still looks better than the bottom. And the needles appear to be on the tips where they're growing out, they're still green. And then when you get closer, you know, to the stem from where they're growing, they sort of turn yellow.
Yeah. I'm guessing you have a spruce, possibly a Colorado spruce, possibly. They do have very small needles in comparison to pines. They are very susceptible to fungal diseases like rhizosphere needle cast. What you might want to do is, if you have a digital camera, take some nice sharp photos of the tree, include some close-ups of one or two branches, also a distant shot of the entire tree, and send that to the plant diagnostic clinic here at Iowa State and see if they can tell by just looking at the photos. If not, they'll need a plant specimen. But send that to pidc@iastate.edu.
All right, Yo, thanks a lot for your call. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. My guests are horticulturist Richard Geron and entomologist Donald Lewis, both from Iowa State University Extension. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me are Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture, and Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension Entomology, and we are ready to take your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Stephanie is on the line in Manchester. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, I have another question about blackberries.
Okay.
We have a patch of wild blackberries, and like you said earlier, they're not extremely productive, so we'd like to increase the size of the patch. So I'm wondering, is it possible to transplant them to a different area?
It's possible, where you would do that early in the spring before the canes begin to leaf out. There's another way of doing that, too. And that is to take one of those canes in midsummer and very carefully bend it to the ground and then peg the end to the ground. It will root, and then next spring you can dig that up and you have a new plant.
Okay, so the best way is to dig and move, basically.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. And you want to do that basically as far as digging and moving in early spring before they have a chance to actually leaf out. At that point, they move fairly well. Now, if you did that, let's say you dug up an existing plant and it was quite big, you would probably cut it back to maybe 8 inches or so, okay, and then dig it up. So it's not going to produce anything that year, but that way you have a small plant. It has a chance to reestablish itself and then should bear the next year.
And do they like full sun? Is that the best area to move to?
Absolutely, they like full sun. We tend to see them in areas where the birds deposit the seed, so we tend to see them in wooded areas, roadside ditches, but actually they do better in full sun.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Stephanie. And Richard, let's clarify some terminology here, because people have been using black raspberries and blackberries sort of interchangeably today.
Right.
They're not the same thing.
They're not the same thing. They're related, but they're not the same thing. And so on a raspberry, when you pull off the fruit, it's hollow at the end, okay, on the raspberries, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the receptacle stays on the actual plant. On a blackberry, when you pull the fruit, it's not hollow at the end. So the receptacle is inside the actual fruit. So that's the difference as far as looking at it.
And we're much more likely to come across a patch of black raspberries than we are blackberries.
Yes, yes.
All right. Next up, we're going to go to Bruce on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning.
What's your question?
I'm calling about grasshoppers.
Oh.
I called last year, and they're definitely early. And we have had the last 2 years infestation. And I've, if you recall, last year I talked about baits and different things, and nothing seems to work. And So this year the gloves are off, and I've bought gallons of seven and different things because this is near Dexter, and they're awful. So I've been spraying, and my concern is how often and what other damage I'm doing to other bugs. But grasshoppers have gotten so bad by the thousands and almost that my wife won't go out and do anything. And it's just difficult. It's the garden, the flowers, everything. So this year, I'm doing them in.
It's the grasshoppers or you. One is going to win.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is one of those puzzles. Why do these problems happen in these isolated areas? What is different that you have so many grasshoppers and most of us don't? Maybe it's some sort of a throwback that your Dust Bowl era again, and we're not. But the grasshoppers spend the winter as eggs in sod. Grasshoppers usually don't spend the winter in tilled soil. They're not in the field. They're not in the garden area itself, but they will be at the edges. They'll be in the waterways. They'll be in the fence rows. They'll be in the ditches. They'll be in our lawns. They'll be in those grassy areas. So those are the areas that we treat when the grasshoppers appear. And it's a little early, but doesn't feel extraordinarily early to have them by now. And when they're small, the insecticides you've mentioned, things like 7 or permethrin, will work well. Bifenthrin, these are all common garden insecticides. All of them have very low mammalian toxicity, very low toxicity to people and pets. Yes, when you spray a lawn area for grasshoppers or you spray a path in the garden where you might see some grasshopper nymphs, the bees that are feeding on white clover in that area are going to be impacted as well. So there will be some trade-offs, and maybe we'll choose to treat the grasshoppers later in the afternoon after the bees have stopped foraging on flowers in those areas. Otherwise, in the lawn, we're not likely to see a huge impact. I would say treatment once a week would be standard operating procedure. If it rains more often than that, and if it seems like there's been a new hatch, you could lower that down every 5 days if necessary.
What breaks the grasshopper cycle? Because we've all seen areas where there were lots of grasshoppers for a year or two and then not so many.
Nature. The real world will break grasshopper cycles, often with either biotic, living, or abiotic, non-living events in the grasshopper's life. One of them is rainfall at the time of hatch tends to be fatal to the grasshopper nymphs. So the small nymphs that are trying to struggle up out of the ground won't make it. Dry weather in the fall of the year sometimes interferes with the female's ability to lay eggs. That could be a limiting factor. And then, just like Richard's blackberries and black raspberries in the woods, insects get diseases. And there's a microsporidian disease of grasshoppers that's fairly common that can be devastating to populations of grasshoppers. They disappear for a while, then the disease dies down, then the grasshoppers come back, then the disease comes back, and they dance through life through the eons that way.
All right. Well, Bruce, I hope your grasshoppers get sick. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Kelly's on the line in Story County. Hi, Kelly.
Good morning. I want to inquire about the best time to trim my yew shrubs.
You can do that midsummer, like in July. I would limit that to more of a light pruning or shearing. You can also prune them early in the spring, like April. And in April, that would be could be a more severe pruning. You can also, if you want, in late summer, early fall, the yews typically send up these really long individual stems, okay? And they really stick out from the rest of the plant. And if you wanted to, you could prune those off, let's say, in September, October. That'd be fine, too.
Okay, so if I want to make it a severe trim, it should be around April sometime.
Yeah, probably early to mid-April before they start to grow, so that as soon as you do that, they have a chance to recover from that.
All right, thanks for your call, Kelly. Ed is up next in Blockton. Hello, Ed.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
We have a community flower garden, and I had to dig up an ancient flowering quince that was planted, unfortunately, underneath a redbud. And we've finally got it out of the ground, but now I have suckers 20 feet away from the original plant,
yep,
all over the yard. How do I get rid of them?
Well, one way to do that is to repeatedly cut them off at ground level. And if you do that, that may take a year or two, possibly longer. Another approach would be to cut these off individually, the suckers or sprouts, and then take a foam-type paintbrush and dip that in some Roundup, and then very carefully apply that to the cut surface. And that means the Roundup will go down into the root system and hopefully destroy a part of that root system. And if you do that repeatedly over time, let's say this year and next year, then you should be able to destroy the root system much quicker than just cutting them off. Cutting them off is going to take a long time before you basically starve the plant to death. That may take 2 or 3 years. If you use a Roundup, it might take a year or two to destroy that root system.
All right, Ed. Thanks a lot for your call, and good luck with that. Susan is up next in Manchester. Hi, Susan.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I have what used to be a whole hollyhock growing, and this year I've got these spores on the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried just kind of a general fungicide. I'm wondering if I'm doing the right. I wonder what it is, and if I lose this plant, can I plant something else there?
It's probably hollyhock rust would be my guess. Hollyhocks and hollyhock rust are synonymous. They're always found together. I mean, they always are, almost. It's a very common fungal disease. And so when that affects the plants, they're not very attractive as far as close up. When you see the foliage, it's not pretty at all. But the flowers still are. The flowers still are. One way to cope with that is, as soon as they're done blooming, cut those plants back to the ground, because they're going to die anyway, and remove that debris from the area and destroy it. Sanitation helps quite a bit. You could use fungicides in the spring, but you have to start early. I'm not sure it's worth that effort. But it's a very common thing, hollyhock rust.
All right, Susan, thanks a lot for your call. Let's do an email question here. This is from Sherry in Walford. She says, I've never had white flies on my flowers and vegetables, but this year everything is infested. My neighbors have the same problem. Why this year, and what can I do to get rid of them?
Well, we may have actually hit upon something where mild winter had an effect. We normally think of our winter weather as being fatal to white flies, and the only way you can reestablish white flies, the way most of us reestablish white flies, is to bring them out of a greenhouse when you plant your bedding plants and your tomatoes and so forth. If it's over a wide area, though, it's kind of hard to believe that we all bought from the same infested greenhouse, brought home the infestation that way. So this may be one where actually there was a little more survival than we normally think through our past winter. White flies feed as nymphs on the undersides of the leaves. The control is to use insecticidal soap, the product you buy at the garden center or at the hardware store. You mix the detergent with water according to label directions. And here's the hard part. Spray the undersides of the leaves. Just sprinkling it across the top of the plant has no effect. You have to actually lay down and spray upward, or use a tip, you bend the tip on the nozzle of your sprayer. Somehow you have to spray upward to hit the undersides of the leaves. If you've got a terrible infestation, do that every 3 to 5 days. Once it gets down to a dull roar, then you can get by once every 5 to 7 days. But it's going to be your hobby to spray the undersides of infested plant leaves until the infestation is reduced.
You always get to recommend such fun things for people to do, Donald.
Well,
you take delight in that.
I try to make it fun. I mean, what fun is it to say, just go spray your plant? I mean, it's like picking things off, picking slugs by hand at night. It's so much better if you just strap the flashlight to the top of your head. Slugs, by the way, have been non-apparent this year. That's one that's down. The hosta growers are sort of enjoying fewer slugs than normal, just like gardeners are enjoying fewer mosquitoes, and it's connected. It's less rain in most of the state this year has led to fewer slugs.
All right, we'll put a couple points on the other side of the scorecard now as well. Norman's on the line from Carroll. Hi, Norman.
Hello. my question is on, I've got currants and gooseberries and black currants, and I need to prune them. Can I do it after harvest?
Boy, I'd prefer to do that in late winter, early spring, March, early April. And basically what you do on those is you look for the oldest stems or branches, because the younger branches tend to be most productive as far as producing fruit. So something that is 1, 2, 3, 4 years old tends to produce a lot of fruit. Anything 5 years old or older tends to be non-productive. So you basically prune out the old growth as best you can.
Okay. Next up, we've got Jen on the line in Atlantic. Hi, Jen.
Hi. I have a quick question. When is the best time to transplant roses? I got two roses mixed up. My climber is where my knockout should have been, and vice versa. What season or what time of year would be the best time to plant, transplant them? They are in good shape now.
Okay. The best time would be early spring, probably early April, before they start to leaf out. That's definitely the best time.
Okay. And one last question today. This is from Ryan in Reasoner. I have a number of black walnuts in what has been, in the last few years, a very wet area. A number of them have died off slowly over this time. They would leaf out late, then turn yellow and drop their leaves early and not leaf out until the next year. These trees were 8 to 10 inches around. I'm starting to see this in trees that are larger, 18 to 20 inches in diameter this year. At first, I thought some of these trees might have died off simply because it had been so wet in this area, but now it's dry and the problem continues. I've seen many woodpeckers bore holes in the dead trees and the dead wood on the standing trees. I usually think of black walnuts as very tough. Any thoughts?
Well, maybe it was too wet in 2008, 2009, 2010. We did have above normal rainfall those years, and that may have caused maybe some root damage. The early leaf drop may have been due to anthracnose or some other disease. But if you're having anthracnose, if you're having root damage, that will cause the trees to decline. Now, last year was quite dry in mid to late summer. And if you have a tree that's under stress that has suffered some root damage, the dry conditions were not good either. So that may have placed additional stress on some of these trees. So maybe some of the trees simply could not cope with all the stress, and they basically died.
Okay, so he's seeing just continued damage from some damp periods.
Well, the weather over the last 4 or 5 years has been very unusual. We had all those years when it was very wet, and then it suddenly turns hot and dry. Last summer was very hot, very dry, and many trees had a tough time coping with that dramatic change to their environment.
And that would mean there's nothing he can do about it.
Probably not, no, unfortunately.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call. That's not good news, but I guess that's part of the business of this program, is to deliver bad news repeatedly.
Thank you. Thank you for making us the specialists of doom and gloom.
Yes. Well, Donald Lewis, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Horticulture Day will be back next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Jason Burns in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. On Monday, doctors from elsewhere learning to speak Iowan. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.